I'm talking to Jim Keck. Mr. Keck, would you please introduce yourself and tell about when you went into the service, what rank you were, and your experience there?
Okay, well, I went in the service in 1943 and took basic training at Leavenworth, Kansas in infantry and was shipped down to Georgia for a period of time to finish basic training. And in between that time, I qualified for going to the Air Force. And so I was in the Air Force for a little bit, but they decided that they didn't need me, and so I went back to the infantry and went back to Georgia, where I had been originally. And we were finished our basic training, and we were going to be shipped overseas as replacements. And I didn't really want to go over as a replacement, and I had done some skiing and had heard about the 10th Mountain. And I was familiar with the sergeant major and told him what I had in mind. And he says, "Well, if you can get me the three letters of recommendation that is required, I'll process them and get you transferred," which I did. And I got transferred to Camp Hale in 1944. And at that time, the group had been out on winter maneuvers for some time, and they had just been finished that and were coming in. And they told me when I got there, because Camp Hale is at 10,000 feet, they said, "We'll give you 10 days to get used to the altitude." And so I did nothing except just try to exercise a little. And at the end of 10 days, they said, "We're shipping out to Texas." So I had none of the training, the skiing, the mountain climbing that the group had. We were in Camp Hale for about a 3-year period doing that training up at 10,000 feet and 12,000 feet and in 10, 20, 30 degrees below zero at times. And I'm told it was a terrible experience, and they would rather fight the war than fight the battle up there in those mountains. So we were sent to Texas to finish some flatland training, which the group hadn't had because they were all up in the mountains, to be trained more or less as an infantry unit. And from there, we got the orders to be shipped overseas. And at the time, we didn't know where we were going, and when we boarded the ship, we were 2 or 3 days out before they said we're heading for Italy. And it took us, I think, 10 or 12 days, something like that. But we landed in Naples, and this would have been in about October of or no, no, November of 44. And from there, I could see that the war had really hit Naples. It had been bombed and strafed by both Germans and Americans, and the people were very, very poor, and there were lots of people that were soliciting food from the soldiers and whatever. But from Naples, we went north in landing craft to a place close to Pisa, where the Leaning Tower is, and we camped there for a period of time. And I do recall that we one night we decided we would go into Pisa just to see the Leaning Tower. And they told us not to leave, but some of us went anyway and went in. And when we came back, we found out we'd gone through some minefields to do this. So it was a little risky, but we made it all right. And from Pisa, we were then sent out into further areas forward and going north all the time, because this is about at the level north of Florence. The American troops had landed in Italy probably a year before we got there, or 9 months, and had fought their way all the way up past Rome, had liberated Rome, and were up north into the Florence area. And the war had been stalemated at that time because they were in the mountains and they couldn't dislodge the Germans with the troops that they had at that time. They had tried to take Mount Belvedere two or three times, but were always driven off because of a ridge called Riva Ridge, which was adjacent to Belvedere and overlooking it. So if they would get to the top of Belvedere, then the soldiers on Riva Ridge would always send their mortars and cannons and whatever and drive them off again. So that's where the 10th Mountain and their expertise came into play, because they had been trained in the mountains and that was their first combat experience. But prior to that time, in one of the towns that we had been stationed at, we were sent out on patrols. And I had been out on a patrol, and we weren't on skis. Some of the patrols were on skis, and that's the only time they used the skis in Europe, was on a few patrols. And when we came back, one of the sergeants came to me and he said, "I need for you to go out on a patrol with me." And I said, "Well, I just got back from one." And he said, "Well, I'll get somebody else." Well, he got somebody else. And that night, a number of those people were killed, including that sergeant. And one of my friends was taken prisoner. So that was a situation where I could have easily have been on that if I hadn't been on a patrol prior to that time. So that was the first near miss, as you might call it. And from there, we stayed for just a short period of time. And then it was in January of 45 that we were sent to the staging area for the Belvedere Riva Ridge assault. And it was in a town close to Vidachatico, and we were all not billeted. We were in tents and close by. And the theme was that they had to take Riva Ridge first because that overlooked Belvedere. And not my group, but another regiment. The 10th Mountain was made up of three regiments, 85, 86, 87. The 86th Regiment had the task of taking Riva Ridge. And so plan was, in the middle of the night, to scale that sheer 2,000-foot ridge. And the Germans left it completely unprotected because nobody is going to come up from that side of things. They managed to reach the summit without the Germans knowing about it and were able to attack them and secure the ridge after quite a bit of fighting. And then the next night, the rest of us in my company, I Company 85th, started up for Mount Belvedere, and our objective was to take that mountain. And that started at 11 o'clock at night, and we were supposed to go without having any shells in our guns because they didn't want anybody firing anything and letting the Germans know where we were. So we started up and worked our way through minefields and through mortars, and there were people stepping on mines and a call for medics at all times. And finally, at about 4 or 5 in the morning, we reached the top of Belvedere. Our company commander had been killed. He was on top of Belvedere and was in a foxhole, but raised up to look around, and a shell caught him in the head, and he and his radio operator were killed. So from there, we had no leaders. They had all been killed. And the sergeant in our group, in the morning when it got light, he said, "If anybody wants to follow me, come along. I'm going to see what's out here." And he and 4 or 5 of us followed him. But I was in a trench. The Germans had trenched around the top of the mountain so that they could see in all directions. And so I was walking in this trench going around, and all of a sudden here's a pair of boots. And then I took another step, and here's a German lying in the trench. And he jumped up just as I had my bayonet in his throat and said, "Don't shoot. Don't shoot, good American." And whatever German I had, I told him to get up with his hands up. and he was one of the first prisoners we took. And shortly thereafter, the other people had started going around, and some of the Germans then started coming out of their dugouts and surrendering. And I don't know whether this guy was sent out there to find out if we took prisoners, because the Germans had been telling their soldiers all the time that the 10th Mountain didn't take prisoners and that they would just kill them on sight. And so maybe they wanted to know that. But anyway, there were quite a few that surrendered at that point, and which more or less helped to secure Belvedere. And there wasn't, from that point on, that much more firefighting. We went into a number of dugouts and would rouse out the Germans. But there, the 10th was fighting in other areas where it wasn't maybe that easy. And I think they had to fight a lot more than we did at that point. But we had already had our casualties getting up there earlier. So from that Belvedere point on, we stayed there for a short period of time and then started moving. We had to, first of all, carry the dead off of the mountain. And this was in winter. And when they die, they're stiff. And I remember carrying off my company commander, who was a football player at the University of Nebraska. And we'd carry the bodies down to a staging area where they were picked up. But that was the more gruesome part of fighting that war. So we consolidated that position and were there for a period of time. And then later on started moving forward, going north. And one time we got to an area where one of my squad leaders, or one of the men of my squad, I heard a shot. There wasn't any Germans around. And I said, well, I went up to him and I said, what happened? He said, well, I accidentally shot myself in the hand. Well, this individual had had all of the war that he wanted, so I had to go testify that it was an accident. Because he was in my squad, I saw him afterwards in the hospital after I had been shot, and he couldn't have felt worse. But everybody in combat does reach a point where that's all I can take. And some of them will shoot themselves, kill themselves, or whatever. And he had reached that point. So we gradually went on and more firefights. And at one point in time, they asked me, we had reached an area and they said, well, take some men and go down and pick up the dog tags off of the dead Germans. And so I took my squad with me and we went down where there were a number of Germans that had been killed. And I remember getting the dog tag off of one German, and I thought, this is a thick packet. And I started looking inside, and here he had a picture of his girlfriend, a beautiful girl. And I said, my gosh, this guy wanted to get home as much as I did. And which was just the story of war. He didn't make it, and I did. So we did our task of picking up dog tags and then went back up to the group and little by little worked our way forward till we reached the final staging area. Now, this would have been in April, and we were there probably 2 or 3 weeks, maybe more, getting ready for the final assault. The assault was to have taken place on the 13th of April, and that's when President Roosevelt died. And so they postponed it to the 14th. But on the 14th, it all started with airplanes and artillery and bombing, and we started moving forward, going north. And got to a certain area, and my platoon lieutenant told me, he said, take your squad, there's a machine gun nest up in the hill there and see what you can do about it. Since I was the squad leader, I said, okay, you know, that's what you do. You don't sit and say, why, I can get killed. But I said to the group, follow me. So we started going around the side of the hill and then started crawling up the hill. And as we were crawling up, all of a sudden my canteen blew apart. And I said, this is no place to be. And just as I jumped, another shell caught me on the other side. I managed to crawl down out of the range of fire. It didn't knock me out, and was able to crawl back a ways where the medics picked me up, and my war was over. They took me from there down to the aid station in the town of Casteldiano. And from the aid station, they sent a telegram home to my parents saying, your son has been seriously wounded. You can write to him at such and such a place. And I have the telegram here. So I was put into an ambulance and taken to Florence to a hospital. And the group then continued to go forward. And while I was in the hospital about 3 weeks to a month, they continued the battle forward. They destroyed two or three German divisions. They crossed the Po River, and the war ended in the northern part of Italy, up in the Lake Garda area. And the Germans wanted to surrender to the 10th Mountain. At that point, I was in the hospital when the war ended, and everybody was tickled with that. The war in Asia was still going on, but at least that's one of them that was over. So after the war, I rejoined the group in an area close to Yugoslavia where we were having some trouble with the Yugoslavs. They apparently wanted to do some things that we weren't agreeable to, but that didn't prove to be anything too special. And then we shipped out to come back to this country. And on board ship coming back, we were being redeployed to Japan. We were to come back, have a period of time, and then head for Japan. But on board ship, we got the news that they had dropped the atomic bomb and the war in Asia was over. So after the war, and after that period of time, I was mustered out and came back to Rapid and ended up going to college at the University of Nebraska. It's funny that when I was in the service, I was in with some people from Lincoln, Nebraska, and when they said they were students at the university, I had no concept of where that was. And for me to end up there at the same school as my company commander, who had died in Mount Belvedere, was a twist of fate, but I was happy that it worked out that way. That's basically the end of the war story. We did go back to Italy 3 years ago, and that's the first time that I had been back. So my wife and I and our son and his wife went there, and we went to the same areas where we had been before. We climbed to Mount Belvedere and went all the way up to the top, and then we went to this little town of Casteldiano where I was wounded. And didn't know, nobody could talk English, but I saw a sign on a building saying municipal. And I went into the building and I said, 10th Mountain Division. And she said, just a minute, and went upstairs, and somebody came down and ushered us up to the mayor of Casteldiano, who couldn't talk any English either. But he called an interpreter by the name of Pietro. And Pietro came and he interpreted everything. And I said, I want to go and try and find out where I was wounded. And he said, we'll take you there. And since Senator Dole and I were wounded on the same day on the same hill. There's a plaque there that commemorates the exact spot where he was shot, and a stream named after him. But they took me, everything was different, so nothing looked familiar, and I didn't recognize anything. But I did say, I remember when I was shot, I was taken to a barn for the initial diagnosis, and they said, there's the barn, and that's where we went. And that's when the interpreter, an older gentleman at one of the houses, hollered, who's there? And he said, somebody from the 10th Mountain. And he came down, and he was just so grateful to see me, and just crying and kissing me and saying thanks for liberating our town. That our group has been back there many times. They have reunions every 5 years and go back to Italy. But part of the reason I wanted to go back was to go to the cemetery, which is south of Florence. And we did look up. The sergeant that had asked me to go on a patrol found his grave and the grave of another person that was killed along with him. We're very, very grateful that it wasn't me. It was just the luck of the draw that it wasn't. I could have very well been in that cemetery too.
Can you tell me what kind of effect being in the war has had on you for the rest of your life?
It gave me maturity. It gave me time to grow up and be serious about life and appreciate the fact that I did have an extra 60 years that the other guys didn't have. And we had 1,000 people killed and 4,000 wounded in a matter of 100 days in combat, which is half of the division. So we weren't there all that long, but when we were in battle, it was intensive. And we're able to break the back of the Germans in Italy. And the war ended, of course, at that point.
Well, we would like to thank you for your service to this country.